Cyril Greenland, and this is Reel 6, isn't it? So you were saying you were taken back to Tientsin at the end of the war.
Yeah.
What sort of state were you all in, would you think, after your war experience?
Not too bad, really, because it hadn't been affected by the war. It was now controlled by the Chinese, because, as I said, the treaty ports were given back to Chiang Kai-shek in 43, 44, I don't know, as a stop, I suppose. We had the Americans there, 25,000 of them, and we mixed with them, a lot of the officers. They stayed until the Chinese threw them out. The Chinese and the mothers of the troops. I think the mothers were anxious to get their sons back after the war, and the Chinese didn't like them being there very much. And they fixed up an incident in Peking. They got a Chinese prostitute to curry favour with an American Marine, and then they accused him of raping an innocent Chinese girl. And the wives and mothers at home, I think, the Americans withdrew in, I think, what would it be, about 47, I suppose, 48, 47, I think. They all went, disappeared. But life continued to be peaceful there. At that time, transferred, I got another job up country with a mining company, and it was away from Tientsin, about 3 hours' journey by train. Quite an isolated communities. Mm-hmm. We had only about 50 Europeans, I think. Some educated Chinese engineers and that sort of thing.
What was the name of the place?
The place was a place called Linshi. Linshi is spelled L-I-N-S-I.
And that was in the north of Tientsin, wasn't it?
Yeah, about 2 hours northeast of Tientsin.
If I could ask you, before you tell me about your experience there, at the end of the war, you and your family, what sort of state were you in physically?
Oh, I think fairly well. We weren't... I lost a lot of weight. I think when the war started, I was about 143 pounds when the camp started. And I dropped down about 20 pounds. It didn't do me any harm, really. We didn't have much illness in the camp, as far as I remember. As I mentioned before, the food was fairly fresh and good. And the canteen food too. And when we got back to Tientsin, everything was quickly back to normal, I think, as far as life was concerned. Except that trading sort of wasn't very good. I was in this accountant of a coal mines in Linshi, and I had to travel to two other mines across the country, which was supposed to be communistic, but I don't know whether it was or not. I never met any. They did attack our little town once, one night. But they had a garrison there of about 3,000 Chinese troops, and I had several problems with them. A group of young officers invaded our club one day and started playing a piano and fooling around. And the number one steward, Chinese chap, rang me up. I was a secretary of the club, of course. So I had to go and throw them out, which they didn't like. And one of them spat at me. Anyway, he played the piano well, I must say that.
These would have been the Kuomintang troops, would they? Chiang Kai-shek.
Chinese troops, yes.
Yes, the nationalists, yes.
Yes.
They
weren't very good. They used to dress with fancy uniforms, and much like the Americans, copied hats and things. And I had another incident with them. Part of my job was to collect... there was terrific inflation at that time. And we used to get three loads of banknotes a week from Tientsin sent down to the mines, probably about 70 or 80 bags of notes, millions and millions of dollars, of course. And it was my job to go and collect them. And I used to go down to the station, which was with about a bodyguard of about a dozen, half a dozen Chinese police, who would have run away at the first shot, I think, if any, and half a dozen labourers to carry the bags off the train and put them on the bus. And at those days, the communists were cutting the line between Tientsin and Peking. And there was no knowing when the train would come in. It was due at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I think. And it never arrived anywhere near that time because the line was continually being cut. And one time it didn't arrive till, 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was woken up and told to go to the station. Anyway, on this particular occasion, we went down there in an old bus that we had. And we collected the money off the train. And when we went to put it into the bus, we found it full of Chinese officers. They'd been up to Tientsin on a conference or something, and they got on the train and saw this bus, they just took it over. So I went in and told them to get the hell out of it. They just sat there, and I went for them in Chinese all the time. He was telling them what it was supposed to be, and all the money, and for the miners, etc., etc. And one of the young officers pulled a gun on me. So I told the colonel to tell him to put it away, which he did. And they didn't actually molest me, but they did pull a gun on me. And they wouldn't move. So in the end, we had about 60 bags of notes, six policemen, eight or ten coolies, about 12 officers, packed in this old bus. Anyway, nothing came of the incident. I reported it, but they didn't. Nothing was done about it. And in actual fact, these troops, or the colonel, went into action against the communists about 3 weeks later and was killed. But they weren't very friendly with us, the Japanese, Chinese military there at all. Except one lot. One lot came in on their way to the front, and they were real fighting troops. And they parked in our offices for about a night. And I had long chats with them because I was a machine gunner at one stage and they had an old Vickers machine gun there. And so I had a nice chat with the troops about this gun. And I mean, they were real soldiers. The others were just playboys. I mean, they lived in comparative luxury and everything else. And we had one come into the house one night. He just wandered through. He'd never seen a foreign house before, had he? So I rang up and they came along and arrested him and shot him out. Of course, I don't know what happened to him, nothing. But, you know, he's an innocent sort of bird, really, but to find a bloke wandering through your house about midnight.
Did you follow the events of the Civil War? Did you know much about Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai and the other communists who had been in Yan'an during the war?
Really after the war, I think. You see, they were so far away. China is such a huge country. And they're so far away. When Mao Zedong invaded the central part, or our part of China, he didn't come across country from Shanxi, where he was. He went all around the northern borders. Now, for some strange reason, we had an American, young American chap came into camp one day and stayed there for about 3 days. I think he was a CIA man.
This is when you were interned, was it?
No, this is when I was in the camp, in my mining job.
Oh, I beg your pardon, yes. Mm-hmm.
He came into to us and stayed with the camp. I got quite friendly with him. I don't know what he did there, that's why I think he was CIA, just to have a look around and see what was happening. And he said, "Sir, when the Mao Zedong gets to Mukden, then you run out quick." And Mukden was up there, and we were down here. So when they got to Mukden, I resigned from the company, as did quite a lot of other people. And that was in October 48. And I finally got out of China on this evacuation ship in November 48.
So that year, October 48, the month rather, to November 48,
yeah.
What were you doing then? You went back to Tientsin?
I went back to Tientsin. I lived with my brother for a month or so.
Where were your family?
My brother was in Tientsin.
Yeah, how about your wife and your wife and son?
We were all together at that time. I didn't fancy staying in the mines under the communists because I didn't want to be interned again. I had this crazy idea that the communists would ship us back to Russia where they were very friendly with them. But actually they didn't. But they didn't. The people who got out in time were okay. But the others who didn't get out by about Christmas or something, 48, they didn't get out for another year. My brother had to stay there another year before they let him out.
So how did you get out in November 1948? Well, how did you get out?
The government commandeered, or whatever, one of the local coastal boats and shipped about, we managed to get on it. The women and children were in the cabins and we were in the second class, which was just bunks in a big open place, and they took us down to Hong Kong, I think, didn't they? No, to Shanghai. Shanghai? Hong Kong. Anyway, eventually we got to Hong Kong and then we flew out to Australia where I spent 23 years.
Was there much panic, you know, when you left? Was there a lot of panic about the communist advance?
I don't think there's actually panic, it's just people said, oh, I suppose we've got to move on. That seems to be, that's the way we looked at it. I didn't want to be interned again anywhere else, so I thought I'd go to Australia, where I had gone in 46 on leave, spent a few months.
Were you able to take anything with you when you left Tientsin?
Take everything. Although when I opened my baggage in Australia, I found that some of the things which I thought were there were not there. Somebody must have gone through them somewhere.
How did you feel about leaving China? Because after all, you'd lived there all your life, hadn't you?
Well, I had given up China, unfortunately. I felt that it was the end as far as China was concerned. And I could have got a job in Hong Kong because I knew several influential people there whom I'd known in Tientsin when they were youngsters or whatever, and they got the big jobs in Hong Kong. And I could have got a job in Hong Kong, but I had this theory that Hong Kong would not last, that the communists would not exactly take it, but they'd freeze it out of business or something. And so I was mad keen to get away from China, I must say. It's a pity, in a way, because I could have had a nice job in Hong Kong, I'm sure. But anyway.
Yes, when you heard about Mao's victory, you know, that the Chinese achieved victory, were you surprised at that, that the Kuomintang...
No, the Chinese, he was winning all over the place. We arrived in Sydney on the 13th of December, the very day that his troops moved into the mines that I had, where I had been working. And had I been there, I would probably have been quizzed, probably not allowed to work. I don't know. I don't know how I would have existed, and especially with a small boy and a wife too. I decided I'd quit. I had to make these horrid decisions. You don't have a choice, really.
But the fact that he had won, you know, somebody like Mao had won, was that surprising, given the support Chiang Kai-shek had received from the Americans?
The Americans pulled out. I don't think they gave them much support when they started to pull out. They certainly didn't leave any troops behind or anything. The whole of this, I told you, these 25,000 odd Marines, they were all pulled out, everything.
And that was by late 1947, was it?
What?
That was by 1947.
Around 47 or early 48, I'm not sure. It must have been 48, because I know they were at one stage they had armed troops on the trains in case they were attacked by the communists, and that was when I was working at the mines, and I joined the mining company on the 1st of April. Not a good day, was it? 1947, I think. So it must have been the end of 47, and by the end of 47, I think, they were probably all out. Out of North China, anyway. And they never appeared since, did they? No, they just stayed out. Of course, at that time, there were no English troops or anything around because of the treaty port had gone back to the Chinese. So we didn't have any English troops there.
So the English had left, really, the English part had finished with the war, had it?
Yes. See, everybody got out. As far as from what I heard, only two people stayed behind when the communists shot everybody else out. Only two people stayed behind. One was a teacher, an independent teacher. The other I can't remember. But what happened to them, I don't know. I really don't know what happened to them. So, there were no foreigners in China at all, apparently. I suppose except a few odd communists or whatever.
Did you tend to follow events in China? You know, were you interested in following events in China under Mao? What was happening?
Yes.
What did you reckon on the post-communist?
Well, you didn't get much out of China, did you, in those days? All you heard about was this little red book or something, and what you read in some of these novels that have been issued afterwards. On my two visits to China, in 1994 and 1998, the Chinese in North China were extremely polite, extremely helpful, no anti-British or foreign feeling at all.
Did you speak Chinese to them? Hmm? You were able to speak with them, were you?
I didn't speak to them very much, actually, because we had a guide, or a Chinese guide all the time, who spoke to English. And so I didn't really speak much Chinese, which I'm sorry about, I should have done. Mm.
What had happened to your area of Tientsin? Did you go round your old area?
Yes, you could travel anywhere.
What did you think of, you know, how were things? Well, what had they done?
The old British concession, the British concession really consisted of three parts. There was the original part, which is a very narrow stretch by the river. And then there was another part added on. And built up. And then the other part was all swamp, which was all dredged, and that was built on. Now, I was not able to walk around very much. I'm not now, actually. And we stayed. The original part of the British concession has been left much as it was, allowed to deteriorate and whatever. Now, I didn't go much beyond that, but beyond that, they're building huge buildings, and the hotels, Hyatt, you name it, they're all building huge hotels around. Now, when we went to China the first time, and the second time, I insisted on staying on the hotels that I knew. And in Peking, we stayed at the Peking Hotel, which in the old days was just a two- or three-story place with about 20 rooms. Now, it was a huge 15-story wide building on the side, and that's where we stayed. And that's where I never stayed there, but we used to have our hockey dinners there. Peking Hockey Club used to give their dinners there. So, and I remember one occasion we all got rather plastered and we were sliding down the banister of the grand staircase, and I've got a photo of Derek Took insisted of taking. Anyway. And in Tientsin, we stayed at the Astor House Hotel, which is the one where I was interned for 3 days, where I had my 21st birthday party, and my parents had their golden wedding party. But that's rather different from what it was. But I got on with all the staff there, and, you know, they were quite interested in my previous occupancy of the place. And the other places we stayed at were I'd never been before, except we did visit the camp, the Wei Shen camp. The first time we visited, on the way out, we flew from Bangkok, because I went down to Bangkok where my son lives, and we flew to Shanghai, and then we got a boat up to Tsingtao, which is still in a wonderful state, because the Germans built buildings that were buildings, beautiful places, and they're still there. And then from there we went to Wei Shen for a day, where we were, it's altered a bit, and it's now a Chinese school, much of it. And the headmaster invited us up into the common room, and we had hot tea and biscuits and things. And then he showed us around his area. Then we had to go around to the other gate, which was a separate place now, and walked around there. This time we went, we met the same bloke and had the same tea, that's the second time, but he didn't show us anywhere. So I don't know what's happened to the rest of it.
Did you get the impression, though, of, do you think the Chinese people in the mass have benefited from the revolution?
I think they must have done, yes. I think they must have done. Because going by train, as we did on various trips round, the old villages, which were mud huts and filthy-looking places, with usually on the outside their Chinese greys, which they build up into a little cone. Going through, on all the journeys, I only saw one place where they had these greys outside, and all the houses in the villages were brick, not mud, as they used to be. And every, I suppose, few miles, I don't know how many, 20 or 30 miles, you could see the chimney of a brick kiln. So they've gone all out to provide better housing for these people. Whether the people, I suppose they must be, we didn't see any discontent or in any way whatsoever, actually. Peking, of course, is a very busy place now with all huge buildings, and there's plenty of employment there, I think, and lots of tourists and lots of money coming in for them. Mm-hmm. So that's a very contented place.
Mm-hmm. Because it's
not a tourist centre.
No.
It was a business centre.
Yes. So. But it was interesting, you know, your story, your life in China was one with this background of conflict all the time, wasn't it? You know, the revolution, the civil wars, the warlords. Mm-hmm. So
there were supposed to be over 400 tribes, as it were, in China.
Yeah, so things have settled down.
Different people where you go.
Yes, but do you think things...
They're about 6 feet high.
Yes.
Huge tribes. Mm. In Tsinsin, they're not... Tsinsin Chinese, I found, on the whole, very nice people.
But things were more settled, were they? More secure for the people? Did they have a more stable life than the one against which you...
I can't speak on that. I can't speak. There'll always be a lot of trouble in China, I think, and I'm very pessimistic that there'll always be a lot of trouble, because it's such a huge country, you see, and governed from a little place called Peking, or Beijing they call it now, of course, which means northern metropolis, and people living, thousands of miles away, you must anticipate trouble all over the place, but who knows, they're not letting their news out. I think on the whole the Chinese are. They got more schools, for example, and we didn't see beggars in the streets like we used to. So I think on the whole, if you ask me, if I have to reply, I'd say probably they're better off. I hate to quote a communist friend in the poor.
Were you ever compensated for what you lost, you know, in China with your business and...
I went to Australia. Now, the Australians got something while I was English. I came over to England to settle in 1971. I left Australia. The English got something when they came over after the war. But I can't get it because it's all closed up. I can't live. However, there is a society called the ABCI. Oh, God knows, not that long. American and British something. who are suing the Japanese government. They want to get us $20,000 each. But they haven't a hope in hell. The Japanese courts have thrown it out a couple of years ago. They put in an appeal, which I believe is to be heard in September in Japan. That'll get thrown out. And the Japanese, as you know, are going through a very difficult time monetarily. So that's another factor which stops us from having them. The British government won't play, although they sort of hint that the British government might give something. But what will they give? 50 quid or something? But I lost everything. My father lost everything. Except a few things that I gave to Germans or non-enemies to look after during the war, which I got back after the war. My shares in China, they're not worthless, you see. So when I went to Australia, I more or less had to start again, except for the bit of money that I picked up after the war. Working.
Well, Mr. Bing, on Eric Liddell, that you knew Eric Liddell,
yes.
Who's very famous, isn't he? Because he
yes.
won a race.
He was in the 1924 Olympics, and he was supposed to run in 100 metres, I think, but it was on a Sunday. So, being a missionary, he refused to compete on the Sunday, and he competed in the 400 metres. I mean, this is history, and he won the 400 metres. He was also an international for Scotland rugby player.
Did you know him in the camp? Was he in the camp with
he
you?
He was, yes, but I met him before the camp.
Yes.
He went out to China in 1924. I went out January 25. The rugby club rang me up and said, do you play rugby? And I said, oh yes, I've played once or twice. Okay, you're playing on Saturday. Eric Liddell was the wing three-quarter. I don't know whether you know rugby or not. I was his inside man. Now you can imagine what sort of a game I had trying to keep up with Eric Liddell. And he at that time was a teacher, I think, in this missionary Anglo-Chinese college. Then I think he went up country, and I never saw him again until the camp, which was not many years later.
Which camp was that?
Weishen camp. All northern people were interned in the Weishen camp. And they had hockey there. He came up to me and said, I'm sorry, I must apologize. I didn't know that you were a hockey player. I was actually captain of the city side of them. And he said, oh, that's why I haven't picked you in these games, because he picked the teams, you see. And after that, I played hockey there.
But did he have a role as... was he organizing sport in the camp?
There was not much sport. They only played hockey. And softball, I think, were the only two outdoor games that they played. They may have played football, I don't know. I didn't play football.
But he had a role, did he, in sports?
Yeah. He was on the committee. As I told you, we had committees for everything. And he died in camp.
What did he die of?
I don't quite remember. Can't remember. Caught some disease, I think, or something.
Was he quite a well-known personality in the camp? Did everyone...
Well, people knew him and of him, but we were all equal there, whether you were the Queen of England or the local dustman. In fact, we were more equal. Some people were more equal than others, but anyway, you know what I mean. that's all I can tell you about him. On two occasions I met him or was with him. Because as a missionary, I think he went up country and preached or whatever they did up there.
Because he's been made out to be quite a sort of hero, hasn't he, in Chariots of Fire?
He's an extremely nice chap. And not sort of missionary type, if you know what I mean. And you don't know because you never met them, but the missionaries are very austere people as a rule. Most of them, anyway. But he was a very nice chap. As I say, I only met him on two occasions. Yes.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Mr. Greenland, for telling me about your Chinese experience.
It's not been too boring.
Oh, not at all. It's been fascinating. And now you're going to show me some photographs, aren't you?
Yes.